The first case on this morning's oral argument calendar is Vegas South Partners v. Mandalay Bay Place, 62427. Ready to proceed, counsel?
I am, Your Honor.
All right.
Good morning, Your Honors. I am Bart Larson of Colasar & Latham, counsel for the appellant, Vegas South Partners, LLC, in this matter. This case arises out of a series of real estate transactions occurring in early 2009. On March 19, 2009, Vegas South Partners entered into a lease agreement with respondent Mandalay Place pertaining to a venue that would eventually be called The Rose. It was to be operated as a burlesque lounge. At the time that lease agreement was executed, it was anticipated that three individuals, Frank Tucker, Greg Jermalowicz, and Justin Levine, would be associated with the operation of The Rose. At or about the time that was signed, Mr. Levine decided he didn't want to have any part in that venue, and he was replaced by another individual, Mitchell Rubinson, who, as Mr. Tucker testified during his deposition, was never formalized, this arrangement, but the parties understood that Mr. Levine was being replaced at that time.
Was not Mr. Levine's name on the documents, though?
It is, yes. And Mr. Tucker testified during his deposition that was essentially an oversight, but that was never corrected. A few months later, in May of 2009, Vegas South Partners entered into another lease agreement with Mandalay Bay Hotel and Casino for a food and beverage venue to be located in the pool area. That lease that was signed in May of 2009 identifies Mr. Tucker, Mr. Jermalowicz, and Mr. Rubinson as a replacement for Mr. Levine. So by May of 2009, undoubtedly, Mandalay knew that Mr. Levine had been replaced. The parties realized shortly after signing the Bamboo Bar lease that they didn't have a lot of time to get the venue up and running in time to meet the summer pool season, which was their intent. So rather than proceed under the Bamboo Bar lease, in June of 2009, they entered into a management agreement, which contained a merger clause, which said that it replaced and superseded any prior agreements between the parties. Now, under this management agreement, there was no rent due from Vegas South Partners to Mandalay Bay. It was an agreement to share revenue from the operation of the venue under Mandalay Bay's existing liquor license. Vegas South Partners spent about $450,000 in tenant improvement work, getting the Bamboo Bar open for business. In June of 2009, they started tenant improvement work on the Rose space. Altogether, over the next couple of months, they spent about $900,000 on tenant improvement work for the Rose. In July of 2009, however, news broke that the Nevada Gaming Commission had filed a complaint against Privé at Planet Hollywood, another nightclub with which these individuals were associated. Based upon the news of that complaint being filed, Mandalay requested that Vegas South Partners cease operations at the Bamboo Bar, which they did. However, Mandalay allowed Vegas South Partners to continue spending money building out the Rose space, with an eye towards opening at the end of August of 2009. Now, on August 20th of 2009, Mandalay advised Vegas South Partners that it was terminating the management agreement for the Bamboo Bar. August 21st of 2009, Mandalay sent a letter to Vegas South Partners questioning their ability to proceed under the lease in light of what was going on at Privé. It was not a notice of default, was not a notice of termination, it was simply a letter questioning their ability to proceed. And based upon that letter, Mr. Tucker and Mr. Jermalowicz agreed to voluntarily withdraw from Vegas South Partners and be replaced. Their partner, Mitchell Rubinson, was going to buy them out. Over the next couple of months, Mandalay and Vegas South Partners continued to discuss an amendment of the lease that would have memorialized that agreement. Now, during this time, as I said, Vegas South Partners continued to spend money building out the space. There are a number of emails going back and forth between the parties indicating that they were preparing to open, discussing marketing and other expenditures and other activities that were taking place in connection with the opening. On November of 2009, Mandalay had finally completed its approval of the individuals that would have replaced Mr. Tucker and Mr. Jermalowicz, and they sent a third amendment to the lease to Mr. Rubinson to execute to memorialize that agreement. Upon receiving it, Mr. Rubinson realized that a very important provision from the lease, Section 28.2, which protected Vegas South Partners against any termination for convenience or any other cause by requiring Mandalay to reimburse them for their tenant improvement expenditures and to pay a $500,000 termination fee, had been removed through that third amendment. You know, he initially felt that he had no choice but to sign it, and he did so, but he immediately retracted that signature before it had been accepted by Mandalay, and the parties were left without an amendment in November. After several weeks of no communication between the parties, Vegas South Partners got nervous. They went to court, asking the court to enjoin Mandalay from terminating their lease and asking the court's permission to deposit the rent that accrued with the court at that time to safeguard against any termination under their lease. And these matters were heard by the district court on December 16th of 2009. During that hearing, Judge Delaney commented that, well, under Section 28.2 of this termination for convenience or any other reason clause, Mandalay can terminate regardless on 60 days' notice. And based upon that, she denied the motion to enjoin termination of the lease. She denied the motion to deposit rent, and that was essentially the end of the Rose lease. There was no formal notice of termination ever sent. After 2.5 years of discovery in the district court action, the parties filed cross motions for summary judgment, which were heard in August of 2012. In September of 2012, Judge Scan, who was by then handling the case, denied Vegas South Partners' motion for summary judgment, granted Mandalay's motion for summary judgment. We feel the district court committed several clear errors in doing that. There were four alleged breaches under the Rose lease. The first dealt with the involvement of Mr. Tucker, Mr. Jamalowicz, and Mr. Levine in the involvement of the Rose venue. The lease did not identify them as key employees, simply stated that they had to be employed on a full-time basis in connection with the operation and management of the venue. Again, they agreed to voluntarily withdraw. Tucker and Jamalowicz, after their future involvement was questioned by Mandalay, Mr. Levine was out from the beginning. He never held an ownership interest in Vegas South Partners. Mandalay clearly did not view this as any breach of the lease because after they had questioned Mr. Tucker and Mr. Jamalowicz's ability to proceed and had been informed that Mr. Tucker and Mr. Jamalowicz would not be involved with the venue going forward, they allowed Vegas South Partners to continue expending money on construction, continue preparing to open. They never sent any notice of default, which would have been required under the lease. And they can't claim this was a breach of the lease because the time for performance never actually arrived. The Rose was never allowed to open for business. So there was never any opportunity for these individuals to be involved in the operation or management of the venue.
Did Vegas South ever formally request substitution of new parties for those three? Because the terms of the agreement were very specific as to who could conduct business and that any change had to be in writing.
Correct. It depends on how you would define formally. There were emails that went back and forth. I don't believe there was any specific formal letter that said we want to replace these individuals with these other individuals. But the record undoubtedly shows that there were a number of other individuals proposed to take over the operation and management of the property. Those individuals went through Mandalay security background checks and were cleared. And the Third Amendment to the lease was drafted, which substituted those parties for Mr. Tucker, Mr. Levine, and Mr. Jamalowicz as the operators and managers of the venue. So whether there was a formal request or not, it's hard to say, but there certainly was discussion, which culminated in that Third Amendment being prepared. And if not for the fact that the liquidated damages provisions were removed, I shouldn't call them liquidated damages provisions. I know that's an accurate way to describe them. But if not for the fact that those early termination fees were removed, the Third Amendment would have been signed, and the parties would have proceeded as originally intended with different operators.
Well, but this case needs to be evaluated on the basis of the executed lease, not the prospects of a Third Amendment.
Absolutely, it does, Your Honor. The lease required that simply that these individuals be involved in the operation and management on a full-time basis. They were willing to do that. It was Mandalay that questioned their ability to be involved in the venue.
Well, but they couldn't, or at least a couple of them couldn't, because of the problems with the privy and the concerns expressed over their licensing capability. Isn't that true?
No, it's not. There was nothing in the lease that required that Mr. Tucker or Mr. Jamal would be licensed. It simply required that they be employed on a full-time basis. There could have been other individuals that had the liquor license for the venue. Nothing in the lease requires that those individuals act as key employees.
Counsel, that's, at one point it's a true statement, but at another point it's a misstatement because the issues were with gaming control. And gaming control is the overall licensee, not just for this, but for Mandalay Bay and its primary license. So Mandalay Bay's concerns, rightfully or wrongfully, were concerned as their overall gaming license, and not to get sideways with the gaming authorities.
Yeah, and I will state that Mandalay's concerns were legitimate. They had good cause to be concerned to raise these issues in light of what was alleged to have happened to Purvey. And rather than argue that point with Mandalay, Mr. Tucker and Mr. Jamalowicz voluntarily withdraw. and to be replaced by other people who Handley felt would be suitable for the operation of the venue. And regardless of whether or not that constitutes...
But that discussion or that sequence begs the whole problem. Mandalay would have the ability to either accept or reject those substitute parties. And if they either weren't tendered, the new parties weren't tendered, or they rejected the one who was going to take over, decided not to go forward without that change in the clause in the Third Amendment lease, then why isn't the court correct when it dismisses the case on summary judgment?
Because Mandalay raised this issue on August 21st of 2009. They allowed Vegas Health Partners to continue spending money and preparing for opening while discussing alternative replacements for Mr. Tucker and Mr. Jamalowicz, who were proposed, cleared the security background checks, and were eventually named in a Third Amendment drafted by Mandalay. Clearly, the intent was to replace these individuals with the alternatives that were proposed by Vegas South Partners.
Well, if it never happened, Vegas South was expending these funds at their own risk in order to be able to be in compliance with other provisions of the lease, right?
Correct. They were making an effort to comply with the other provisions. They were spending money preparing to open. One important point I may have glossed over is that Mandalay never gave any notice of default. Under the lease, a breach of this nature, anything other than payment of rent, essentially, requires that Mandalay provide notice of default and a 30-day opportunity to cure. There is not one piece of paper anywhere in the record in which Mandalay advises Vegas Health Partners that it was ever in default of either lease or the management agreement.
Is that required under Section 28.2?
Well, Section 28.2 states that Mandalay can terminate the lease on 60 days' notice for any reason or for no reason. It's hard to get much broader than that. Mm-hmm. Termination for cause or without cause. And upon such termination, Mandalay is required to reimburse Vegas Health Partners for its unamortized tenant improvement expenditures and pay $500,000 on top of that. Now, Mandalay will argue that's unreasonable because they could be running a criminal enterprise out of the space or what have you, and we would still be required to pay them. But it's not unreasonable because Mandalay still retains their claims for damages if they terminate for cause, which could either partially or even fully offset whatever might be owed under Section 28.2.
So wouldn't your argument in this case be, and to the district court, shouldn't it be, regardless of notice, you're entitled to the reimbursement under that clause?
Absolutely. That was our argument, mm-hmm. that whether it was the termination was for cause or without cause, it was never decided by the court which one it would be.
Mm-hmm.
But either way, we're entitled to be reimbursed the $900,000 we spent on construction costs preparing to open, plus an additional $500,000 on Section 28.2. And Mandalay may very well have claims for breach that would offset that. But that doesn't change our entitlement to those reimbursements and that $500,000 fee under Section 28.2.
Are you taking a position that Vegas South Partners also fulfill their obligation of immediately after execution applying for their respective liquor licenses, even after they voluntarily withdrew them and then did not attempt to reinstitute?
Absolutely. What the lease requires is that they immediately apply for a liquor license, then let that liquor license not be suspended, revoked, or limited. They applied for the liquor license the day the lease was signed on March 19th of 2009. When it was requested that Tucker and Jamalowicz withdraw from Vegas Health Partners and be replaced, the liquor license application was, of course, withdrawn. Vegas Health Partners was not able to reapply for that liquor license without the Third Amendment to the lease, which was not drafted by Mandalay until November 2009 and was unacceptable as drafted to Vegas Health Partners. It's a condition of Clark County Code that in order to apply for a liquor license, there has to be a valid lease in place.
Well, there was a valid lease, but the lease didn't name other parties.
No, it did not. But again, that goes back to the fact that it was Mandalay who requested that they withdraw. Rightly or wrongly, it was Mandalay's request. Vegas Health Partners agreed to it, continued to act in good faith, continued to spend money preparing their space for occupancy.
And that's, I understand what you're saying from a clear standpoint, but as we then interweave the other enterprise that the players were involved with and the action as to that license and other licenses which would have impacted their liquor license comes into play. So was that just a fact that you weren't supposed to consider in looking at how this was working?
I would say it's something that shouldn't be considered, but again, under the lease, Mandalay has the obligation to provide a notice of default and an opportunity to cure In this case, it was a problem that was at least in part of Mandalay's own making by requesting that Mr. Tucker and Mr. Jamalowicz withdraw and be replaced by somebody else. Vegas South Partners wasn't able to go forward and reapply for that liquor license until the Third Amendment release was in place, which unfortunately never happened.
If your client, let's assume hypothetically, hadn't even submitted the application, would you be entitled to the refund provided for under 28.2?
Under the plain language of the lease, I think so. Again, Mandalay would have a claim for damages which could offset that. I see that my time's up. If you'd like me to continue, I will.
You can finish your response if you have anything else to add to the argument.
Simply that under the plain language of Section 28.2, the reimbursement and fee for termination still applies to be offset by any claim that Mandalay might have for a breach of the lease.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Smith.
Good morning, Your Honor. Jordan Smith of the law firm Pisanelli Bice on behalf of respondents Mandalay Bay and Mandalay Place. And may it please the Court. The District Court correctly granted summary judgment against the affirmative claims of Vegas South and in favor of the breach of contract claims of Mandalay Bay and Mandalay Place. First, I'll address why there are no genuine issues of material fact that Vegas South breached both the Bamboo lease and Rose lease by failing to pay rent, failing to obtain a liquor license, and improperly attempting to transfer their ownership interests. Next, I'll discuss why Vegas South cannot recover as a matter of law.
Well, maybe you could start with a different place. What provision in the lease are you relying upon to terminate the lease?
Although Vegas South committed multiple breaches of both leases, the breach that is dispositive of this appeal is Vegas South's failure to pay rent under both leases. Vegas South, as we've been discussing this morning, breached multiple provisions, but the breach that's dispositive of this appeal is Vegas South's failure to pay rent. There's no question that Vegas South failed to pay rent under both leases.
And under those circumstances, what does the lease provide regarding notice of default for non-payment of rent?
Section 24.1A of the Rose lease and Section 21.1A of the Bamboo lease defines the failure to pay rent after notice and opportunity to cure as an event of default. There's no question that notice for failing to pay rent was provided to Vegas South under both the Bamboo lease and Rose lease. Each of those notices is included in our record at pages 619 to 658. For example, the court can see that on page 619 of our record, there's an example of a notice of default under the Bamboo lease. And that notice specifically references the default provision for failing to pay rent, section 21.1A. Similarly, at 623 of our record, there's an example of a notice of default under the Rose lease. And that notice, too, like all the others, specifically references the notice of default provision 24.1A. There's no question, based upon the notices that were before the district court and that are included in our record, that Vegas South received notice of its failure to pay rent and that it was in default. The default provisions, the rights and remedies provisions of Section 24.2 of the Rose lease and 22.1 of the Bamboo lease granted Mandalay Bay and Mandalay Place the ability to retake the premises and pursue unpaid rents under the default provisions, which is exactly what happened here. There's no question, and Vegas South does not challenge on appeal, the amount of rent due and owing to Mandalay Bay and Mandalay Place. Those amounts are easily calculable based upon the lease provisions and the number of months that transpired under both leases before the leases were terminated in December of 2009. Rather than challenge the amount of the judgment against them, Vegas South argues on page 28 of its opening brief that Mandalay Bay and Mandalay Place cannot recover unpaid rents beyond December of 2009. However, in the district court, both Mandalay Bay and Mandalay Place only sought past unpaid rent up to and including December of 2009. They had the ability to collect future unpaid rents, but did not do so. Therefore, the failure to mitigate argument raised by Vegas South is inapplicable. And even if it did apply, it's Vegas South's burden as a defendant to prove the failure to mitigate damages, and there's evidence of mitigation in our record. For example, Renee West, an employee of Mandalay Place, testified on page 1022 of the record that the place venue was shown, the row space was shown to a prospective group, despite the fact that the parties were negotiating a third amended lease. In their reply brief, and today in its
discussion. Is there not a question of fact created by the argument that Mr. Martin communicated that Mandalay did not expect rent payment while the negotiations were taking place for the Third Amendment?
No, Your Honor. The only evidence of that in our record stems from requests for admissions that were served in an unrelated case between Vegas South and its attorney, Jay Brown. Those requests for admissions were not served in this action, and under NRCP 36, requests for admissions are only admissible in the action in which they're served. Additionally, that evidence, which counsel for Vegas South in the court below referred to himself as irrelevant at page 1461 of the record, that evidence goes to a waiver argument, and both leases, both the Rose lease and Bamboo lease, contain anti-waiver provisions that require any waiver of a breach to be in writing. That's section 27.13 of the Rose lease and 27.1 of the Bamboo lease. Additionally, and I should point out, there is no written waiver of a breach for failure to pay rent, failure to obtain a liquor license, or improper transfer of ownership interests. These anti-waiver provisions also preclude any argument of an implied waiver of the right to assert a breach or estoppel. This court has not specifically so held, but other courts in our sister jurisdictions have. I point the court's attention, for example, to the Rybovich Boating Works v. Atkins case. That's R-Y-B-O-V-I-C-H. It's a 1991 decision by the Florida District Court of Appeals, which holds that anti-waiver provisions that require breaches to be in waiver of a breach to be in writing preclude any implied waiver or estoppel arguments. Again, Vegas South's undisputed failure to pay rent after notice and opportunity to cure is a material breach of both leases and is dispositive of this appeal. Moreover, the management agreement for the Bamboo lease, or for the Bamboo space, does not preclude Mandalay Bay's ability to recover unpaid rent under the Bamboo lease. The management agreement was a temporary stopgap measure negotiated between the parties to allow Vegas South to operate the pool bar during pool season under Mandalay Bay's liquor license, while Vegas South worked to obtain its own liquor license. Although there is an integration clause in Section 26 of the management agreement, that agreement states that it supersedes any prior agreements regarding the subject matter of the management agreement, which is Vegas South's ability to operate the space under Mandalay Bay's liquor license. That integration clause does not supersede all other agreements between the parties. And as this court found earlier this year in In Re K Clubs, full evidence is admissible to explain any matters that the contract is silent upon. Here, neither the management agreement nor the Bamboo lease specifically discusses the relationship between the two agreements. And here, all of Vegas South's executives testified that the management agreement was just a temporary stopgap measure and that the lease remained valid despite the fact that the management agreement was entered into. Section 20 of the management agreement demonstrates that the term of the management agreement was only for a period of 90 days maximum, and that it could be terminated upon 5 days' notice without further liability. Each of Vegas South's executives, for example, one of the purported owners, new owners, Mitchell Rubinson, testified that it was his opinion that even after the management agreement was terminated, the lease remained valid. That testimony is at page 1070 of the record. Mr. Rubinson is also the one that described the management agreement as a stopgap at 1068. Frank Tucker himself stated that it was his understanding that as soon as Vegas South obtained its own liquor license, the Bamboo lease would, quote, kick in. His statements to that effect are on page 1097 of the record. But despite the fact the management agreement was entered into, that does not preclude Mandalay Bay's ability to recover rent under the Bamboo lease as soon as the management agreement was terminated. The second material breach of both leases stems from Vegas South's failure to obtain a liquor license. Both leases in section 5.7 of the Rose lease and 7.14 of the Bamboo lease obligated Vegas South to obtain a liquor license. As the parties have pointed out, Vegas South applied for that and voluntarily withdrew that application. To avoid that breach, Vegas South claims that it was not provided notice and an opportunity to cure. However, the plain language of both Section 5.7 of the Rose lease and 7.14 of the Bamboo lease states that the failure to obtain a liquor license will constitute an event of default and result in the, quote, immediate termination of the lease. The language immediate termination of the lease demonstrates that the 30-day notice to cure period does not apply. It could hardly be considered an immediate termination if Mandalay Bay or Mandalay Place had to wait 30 days before effectuating that termination.
But factually, they weren't denied.
They weren't denied. The application was not denied because it was voluntarily withdrawn. That's true. On that point, Vegas South claims that this time for performance had not arisen. However, both leases contain time is of the essence provisions at 27.16 of the Rose lease and 27.12 of the Bamboo lease. The voluntary withdrawal of its application is at odds with the requirements of acting as if time was of the essence. Moreover, when the case was initiated by the motion for preliminary injunction by Vegas South, it requested that it be allowed to, quote, immediately operate the Rose space. To immediately operate the Rose space would have required a liquor license, which they did not have. And so their own request to be allowed to immediately operate the Rose space indicates that at least as of December 2009, Vegas South itself got its time for performance and the requirement to have a liquor license was at hand. So the failure to obtain a liquor license is the second material breach that warrants affirmance. The third material breach, third and fourth material breach, because they're closely related, stems from Vegas South's attempt to transfer its ownership interests. The prohibition on the improper attempt to transfer ownership interests without written consent ahead of time by Mandalay Bay is found in Section 15.1 of the Bamboo Lease and 21.1 of the Rose Lease. And this is closely related to the other breach of the Rose Lease in Section 12.6F, which requires that Tucker, Jamalowitz, and Levine be employed on a full-time basis in connection with the operation and management of the premises. These three provisions were breached by the attempted transfer of ownership interests from Tucker, Levine, and Jamalowitz to Mitchell Rubinson and Roman Jones, and Roman Jones in particular. Roman Jones was a complete stranger to the transaction, was not listed on any schedule or exhibit to either one of the leases. Yet, without Mandalay Bay or Mandalay Place's prior written approval, he's now an officer of Vegas South, as memorialized in the Secretary of State's own records, which are included in our record at page 923. Even before the purvey allegations came to light, Vegas South was in breach of Section 12.6F and both of the non-transfer provisions. Levine himself, as Frank Tucker testified, was no longer involved in the operation of Vegas South even before July 2009 when the Gaming Control Board's complaint came to light. After the complaint came to light, Mitchell Rubinson testified himself that he attempted to remove Tucker and Jamalowitz and made them, quote, out, disappeared, and no longer involved. His testimony is at 1073 to 1077 of the record. Frank Tucker himself admitted that at the end of September and early October, without any written approval from Mandalay Bay or Mandalay Place, he had entered into an agreement with Rubinson and a new ownership entity to transfer his interest in the interest of Mr. Jamalowitz. Again, there was no written approval for that transfer, and that testimony can be found at page 1089 to 1095 of the record. This improper attempt violated both Section 21.1 and 15.1. Again, just as with the breach for the failure to obtain a liquor license, Vegas South claims that it was not provided the notice and opportunity to cure the improper attempt to transfer. However, Section 21.1 and 15.1 defines the improper attempt to transfer of ownership interest as a, quote, material incurable event of default. The phrase incurable event of default demonstrates that the cure period in Section 24.C and 21.C, respectively, does not apply. So the lack of notice with regard to the improper attempt to transfer does not prevent a finding of breach. Also in its brief, Vegas South relies on...
What does the record show regarding Johnson's interest in the company? He's an officer, but did he have an interest in the company?
Jones.
Jones.
In the record, Jones's specific ownership interest and the corporate structure, there's nothing in the record, I'm unaware of anything in the record that says his specific percentage of ownership or what exactly his role internally was. The only evidence in the record regarding Jones's transfer into Vegas South stems from the Secretary of State's records, which again are included at 923 of the record, showing that he's an officer and that...
How is his being an officer violative of the transfer clause?
The transfer clause prohibits any attempt to transfer or transfer of an ownership interest. I would imagine that as an officer, he has some sort of ownership interest.
But on summary judgment, we're not going to speculate about his ownership interest.
Understood, Your Honor.
So you're relying on, I don't know that Jones is the best argument for you on that clause.
I agree that it may be unclear whether Jones himself has an ownership interest. But again, both provisions prohibit any attempted transfer. Jones was a stranger to the transaction, so whether or not Jones actually obtained...
But the record is he's an officer. There's nothing in the record to show an ownership interest, correct?
There's nothing in the record that shows that Jones actually obtained an ownership interest. That's correct. However, again, I would emphasize...
And didn't Mandalay agree to accept, I get these names fouled up, Rubinson, as the substitute for the other two?
No, Your Honor. Rubinson was on the Bamboo lease as an exhibit. So Rubinson does have some connection to the Bamboo space. He has no connection to the Rose space. So his attempted transfer with regard to the Rose space is a breach. Jones' attempted transfer, and again, even though the record may be unclear whether Jones actually obtained an ownership interest, 21.1 and 15.1 precludes the attempted transfer. So even Jones had no connection to either the Bamboo space or the Rose space.
In your motion for summary judgment, did you rely at all on 28.2 as a basis for terminating these leases, or the Rose lease, I should say?
I presume Your Honor is referring to the motion for preliminary injunction at the beginning of the case.
Yeah.
The only reference to 28.2 there, and there was no written order entered in regards to that. But that was explained at the hearing below at page 1445 of the record. The only reference by Mandalay Place with regards to 28.2 was in the alternative, in regards to the irreparable harm element of the requested preliminary injunction. The opposition to that motion is included in our supplemental appendix, and it's clear from that opposition that the only reference to 28.2 pertained to an alternative argument that even if Vegas South was correct when it requested the preliminary injunction, there was no irreparable harm because, hypothetically, Vegas South could obtain money damages, so there was no irreparable harm sufficient to warrant a preliminary injunction.
But I thought the district court at page 1423 of the record said, in reconciling this reimbursement provision, the lease does not provide that Vegas South can fail to pay rent and otherwise breach the lease and still receive a buyout as a consequence. The lease must be read as a whole, giving meaning to all of its provisions. So in that language, did the district court attempt to address the rights, if any, of Vegas South under the reimbursement clause?
Yes, Your Honor, and that the district court statement seems to endorse Mandalay Place's position, that it would be absurd that a tenant that is in breach would receive a $500,000 payment under 28.2. Reading the lease as a whole, 28.2 only applies when a tenant is not in breach, and when a tenant is in breach, the default provisions of 24.1 and 24.2 are applicable. Unless the court has any other questions?
No, thank you.
We respectfully request that the district court be affirmed. Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Larson, you used up your time, but I'll give you a minute in rebuttal.
With regard to the arguments concerning the transfers of ownership interests, I will point out that Mr. Tucker and Mr. Jamala, which actually intervened in the district court action, obtained declaratory judgment from the district court on June 1st of 2010, indicating that they had never transferred their interests to Mr. Rubinson or Mr. Jones, that the agreements they entered into in late 2009 to transfer those interests were expressly contingent upon Mandalay approving those transfers. So to argue that there was any transfer of ownership interest that was violative by their lease, I think it's absurd. The district court has already determined that that was not the case, and then that's not something that was brought up on this appeal. With regard to payment of rent, again, I'll point out that...
What's your rebuttal to your opponent's argument that record sites 619 and 623 provide a basis for notice of default for non-payment of rent in the Bamboo and Rose lease?
The invoices that were sent out were invoices indicating that pursuant to this particular section of the lease, this is your notice that rent is due. None of those notices specifically stated that you were in default or threatened any sort of consequence for failure to pay rent. What the record would show, if you look at the deposition transcripts, is my clients received these notices, were uncertain as to whether or not rent was actually due because they were in the process of negotiating the Third Amendment of the lease. And Mandalay had been silent except for sending out these notices. So to the extent that these notices went out, they're not notices of default. They do, of course, reference the lease itself, but there's nothing that would constitute a five-day notice to pay rent or quit, or any other sort of notice of default or sort of termination that would have advised my clients that they were at risk of losing the lease for failure to pay rent at that point in time.
Okay, thank you for your arguments, counsel, here today and your briefs. The matter will stand submitted.